Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's always good to be together on the Lord's Day. Good to be together to worship God. If you're like me, reading through some of these prophecies in Ezekiel are a bit puzzling, some more than others. And so this morning I'd like for us to spend some time taking a look at one of these in particular that has been puzzling to me, perhaps puzzling to you as well. But before we get into that, I'd like for us to turn over to Revelation chapter 20. Revelation chapter 20, we're going to begin reading at verse 7. When the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. And they will be tormented day and night, forever and ever. So we're going to be taking a look this morning at this passage, but we're going to need to turn over to the 38th chapter, 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel, to see how what we read in Revelation is related to this prophecy of Ezekiel in chapters 38 and 39. So while you're turning there, I'd like to add to Tony's welcome this morning to those who are visiting with us. We're glad that you were able to be with us this morning. Jason, our other elder, as Tony mentioned, is out of town. And by way of context, for those visiting with us, we are in the process of reading through the entire Bible this year and reading through it in a chronological fashion. And so for the past few weeks, we've been focused on reading through the prophecies of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. I'd also like to thank Trent for leading us through the good study and discussion this morning in this week's readings. So in chapters 38 and 39, there is this prophecy relating to or pertaining to Gog and Magog. In the first six verses of chapter 38, what we see is that God is against Gog. And so this raises the question in our minds. Let's see. There we go. Of who is Gog, or what is Gog? Who is Gog, and what is Magog? Well, we're told a little bit of information about this in the text itself. We're told that Gog is the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. Together, the land of Magog. And then, along with Magog, according to verse 5, are gathered together Persia, Ethiopia, Put, Gomer, and Beth Togarmah from the remotest parts of the north. So that should clear it all up, right? Some of these nations are probably or may not be immediately familiar to us. But if we turn back to Genesis chapter 10, we get a little bit more insight into what Ezekiel is describing in this prophecy. So in the 10th chapter of Genesis, what we have is the account of the descent and the lineage of humanity following the flood, descending from the three sons of Noah, who were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And just looking in verses 2 and 3, the sons of Japheth were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tiras. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarmah. So we see a little bit about what these names are in Ezekiel 38 from this information we get about the descendants of Japheth. And then one of the nations that is mentioned in gathering together with Magog is Put. And if you drop down to verse 6 there in Genesis chapter 10, we see that Put was one of the sons of Ham, the son of Noah. So, to maybe put all of this in a little bit of context, here is a map, and what's circled here are the names that we just read from Genesis chapter 10, and that are referenced in over in Ezekiel. So in the far north, you see Magog, and then we see the names Meshach, Togarmah, Ma, Tubal, Gomer, and so forth, Put down near Libya, and then Ethiopia down in the far south. We've also circled Tarshish to the far west, and Dedan and Sheba to the far right. They come up a little bit later in the prophecy, so just make a note of where those are. So this helps us maybe to understand a little bit more about the geographical imagery that Ezekiel is using here, but also the extent of the opposition against God's people. Turning back to Ezekiel chapter 38, now if you drop down to verse 15, we see this description of the gathering, this alliance that's against God's people, described as many peoples and a great assembly. So let's break down then the components of this prophecy in chapter 38. In verses 4 through 6, the prophecy really begins with the end, in a way. There's an implication here of comfort from God, because God's going to foretell this opposition that comes against his people, but he really starts off by saying he's going to turn it away. And that's the ultimate end. And then in verses 7 through 9, Gog is told to gather his forces and to prepare themselves and to be on guard to protect this assembled force and to wait, essentially. And then he's told that after some amount of time, Gog and his assembled army, this massive army, would be summoned to come up against the land of Israel. And this would come at a time after Israel had returned to their land from captivity, and they're described as living securely in the land, so they're prosperous, although they are defenseless at the time. Then in verses 10 through 13 of this prophecy, as this immense army is advancing toward Israel, Gog would devise his own evil plan, a plan that's motivated by his own greed. He would decide to turn aside and to capture spoil and seize plunder from God's people. And in addition to this massive army that has assembled against God's people, it's mentioned here that Sheba and Dedan and Tarshish that we saw on the map earlier, they want in on this too. They were merchant peoples. So Sheba and Dedan were Arabian merchants, and Tarshish, they were seafaring merchants. And so they want in on all of this spoil as well, perhaps from the trading opportunities that it would present. And so it seems like the whole world is assembled and aligned against God's people. Then in verses 14 through 16, God would bring Gog and Magog up against Israel, but he would do this for his own purpose, which is, he says, so that the nations may know me when I am sanctified through you before their eyes, O Gog. So all of this that's described in this prophecy is playing out for the glory of God. Then in the last part of this chapter, verses 17 through 23, the prophecy really begins to reach its climax. And it begins with noting that Gog and Magog are actually the ones about whom other prophets in former days had spoken. And the prophecy expresses this in the form of a rhetorical question. And there are not any specific prophecies that are really referenced here verbatim, just that they were prophesied in former days by other prophets. But if we look quickly over at Zephaniah, in Zephaniah chapter 3, Zephaniah prophesied as a refresher during the reign of Josiah, so many, many years earlier than Ezekiel. In Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 8, God says, "Therefore wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day when I rise up as a witness, indeed my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out on them my indignation. All my burning anger for all the earth will be devoured by the fire of my zeal. So we don't know that this prophecy in Ezekiel is necessarily referring directly to this prophecy in Zephaniah, but we can see certainly a harmony there and a connection there perhaps throughout Zephaniah as well as other prophets. Ezekiel then prophesies that when Gog and Magog would come up against Israel, God's fury would mount against Gog and Magog, and God would utterly defeat Gog and Magog. The prophecies here use the language of nature and of cataclysmic events to really describe the suddenness and the extent of this defeat that Gog and Magog are going to experience. And then God announces his ultimate purpose in this action in verse 23. He says that, "I will magnify myself, sanctify myself, and make myself known in the sight of many nations, and they will know that I am Yahweh." The prophecy then continues into chapter 39, and it continues to elaborate further on the extent to which God would defeat Gog and Magog. And in this part of the prophecy, God further reveals his purpose in doing this. In verse 6, part of his purpose is that they will know that I am Yahweh. In verse 7, he says, "My holy name I will make known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let my holy name be profaned anymore. And the nations will know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel." Now, the nations had profaned Yahweh's name really by assuming, in multiple ways. But one of the ways was in assuming that Israel had been taken off into captivity and destroyed because the Lord really was not able to protect them or to save them or prevent that from happening. However, with this action now that the Lord is taking, he's going to make it very clear to all of the nations that Israel went into captivity for their sin, and that he was the one who then brought them out into their land and is protecting them. So then this prophecy concludes with a message of hope and restoration for Israel, and God's statement that he would restore the fortunes of Jacob, and specifically that he would be jealous. He says, "I will be jealous for my holy name." He says, "I will be sanctified through them in the sight of the many nations. They will know that I am Yahweh, their God, and I will have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel." Now, it's difficult at best to attribute this name Gog, this individual, this character, to any particular political leader in history. There seems to be, however, a reasonable consensus among scholars who have studied this in depth that Gog may be a reference to the historical character Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a leader in the area of Syria, the northern part of the later Greek Empire. So remember, Alexander the Great, Greek Empire, after him, it was divided into four different parts. Ultimately, it kind of coalesced into a northern and a southern part. And Antiochus Epiphanes was the leader of the northern part at one point in history. And he was adamantly opposed to God's people, to Judaism. And he attempted to Hellenize the land of Israel and to stamp out Judaism completely through persecution and through desecrating the temple at that time. And there are prophecies over in Daniel that even more clearly point to what he would do and the character that he was and the opposition that he would bring. And without getting into a whole detailed history of Antiochus Epiphanes, there was a time when he was heading over to Alexandria. Antiochus Epiphanes had set himself up as king of Egypt. He had defeated the then king down there of the southern part of the Greek Empire, which was in Egypt. But Alexandria had revolted, and so he was on his way over there to subjugate Alexandria when Rome stepped in and actually thwarted him and stopped him. And he was returning back to the north. He turned his attention to the land of Israel and attempted to really plunder it, but he was actually stopped, and he was defeated at that point. He then ended up back up in his home country in Syria, where he then shortly thereafter died. And it was a horrible death, from what I understand, a death of a horrible disease. All of this occurred within about the 2nd century B.C. And it is notable that that was the last significant attack on God's people before the arrival of the Messiah, before the arrival of Jesus. But regardless of the specific fulfillment of the prophecy, we can be assured that the primary audience of this prophecy understood it as a message of hope and restoration. And we can understand that as a significant threat to God's people that God allowed, but that God would ultimately, to his glory, stop it. We can also be assured that when it was fulfilled in history, that God's people understood the prophecy and understood its fulfillment. So now let's go and turn our attention back over to Revelation chapter 20, with kind of that as background for what we see here. So we'll take a look at the language of this prophecy, and this time let's back up to verse 1, and we'll read all the way down through verse 10 together. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Then I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark on their forehead and on their hand, and they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power. But they will be priests of God and of Christ, and will reign with him for 1,000 years. When 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So as we read through this and we study this passage, as well as really the whole book of Revelation, there are some fundamental things that we need to recognize and to acknowledge. And the first is that Revelation is written in symbolic language. And in fact, if we go back to the very beginning, the introduction to the book, chapter 1, verse 1, we learn that God showed John, the author, things that would soon take place, signifying it. That is, he showed John these things by signs. So it wasn't a verbal revelation as much as it was a visual revelation to John with these signs. Then we also need to realize that this passage that we just read, it's in the middle of a sequence of visions that were revealed to the Apostle John. And the visions themselves really begin back in chapter 19. So if you look at chapter 19, a page over, verse 11 begins with, "And I saw." Then verse 17, the second vision, "Then I saw." And verse 19, "Then I saw." Chapter 20, verse 1, "Then I saw." Chapter 20, verse 4, "Then I saw." Then down at verse 11, "Then I saw." And finally, chapter 21, verse 1, "Then I saw." So there's a series of seven visions. It's a very consistent pattern that we see throughout all of Revelation. We see the seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls, seven statements of blessing, and so forth. There's a pattern to Revelation, and these visions certainly fit within that pattern. These two particular visions that we just read, which are the fourth and the fifth, they follow the vision in chapter 19, in which the allies of Satan, who there is depicted as a dragon, his allies, the beast and the false prophet, are cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. Then the visions in chapter 20 really focus on the ultimate outcome of Satan himself. And not to say that all of this is sequential and happening one after the other necessarily, but it's another description of God's victory over Satan. Revelation just reveals things over and over and over, essentially the same story multiple ways. And think of it as it's kind of a layered narrative rather than a linear one. Now, the Lord revealed these visions to the Apostle John at a time when God's people were under severe persecution from the Roman Empire. And this letter, with its images and its visions and its signs, it's a message of hope for those Christians who were suffering greatly for their faith in Christ. It's also a message of hope for Christians in any age who are suffering for their faith, and for us as well. And then one last thing is kind of fundamental is the ultimate doom of Satan. That's the ultimate point of these visions. It's not the 1,000 years, it's the ultimate outcome, the ultimate doom of Satan and the victory of Christ and his people. And so what do we see in these visions? We see Satan bound for 1,000 years so that he would not deceive the nations any longer. We see thrones and souls of those who have been slaughtered for their faith reigning with Christ. We see Satan having some level of influence. It's described as him being released, and he deceives and gathers together other allies, and this is where we see Gog and Magog, to oppose and to war against God's people. But the ultimate outcome of Satan, Gog, and Magog is that they are devoured by a fire from heaven. And Satan is cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are already and tormented forever. John's readers would have recognized this image of Gog and Magog as representing some significant worldwide threat against the Lord's people, very similar to what it meant back in the prophecy that Ezekiel revealed and preached and prophesied as well. So what is the meaning of all of this, and what does it mean for us? Well, one thing is there's no shortage of interpretations on this passage. But we can look at it at least at a high level. In verses 1 through 3, this constitutes the fourth vision in this series. We see the doom of Satan and the victory of Christ and his people, and that is, in fact, the main point of this prophecy. It's not the 1,000 years. The purpose of the revelation was to set forth this promise of the ultimate and certain triumph of Christ and those who were being so severely persecuted. And in this vision, those Christians under Roman persecution would have seen their adversary, Satan, stopped from deceiving the nations, specifically in the matter of emperor worship, which was the source of their persecution at that time. The 1,000-year period, it's not literal, perhaps not even referring to a length of time, but maybe more representing an idea, the idea of completeness, and that Satan would be completely restrained from deceiving the nations worshiping the Roman emperor. Then the fifth vision in verses 4 through 6 of it, we see the triumph of the martyrs who had already died for their faith in refusing to worship the emperor. And again, the 1,000-year reign here is not to be taken literally. Christ's triumph and the triumph of the martyrs is a complete triumph. There's no contingency to it. This message would have brought a lot of consolation and assurance to the living disciples who were already bereaved of those who had died for their faith. And then that brings us to the second part of this fifth vision in verses 7 through 10, and Gog and Magog. And it connects to what we read over in Ezekiel chapter 38 in that prophecy. And just like the other images that are used throughout Revelation, you know, there's a dragon, there's a beast, there's periods of time and so forth, Gog and Magog represent significant opposition to God's people affected in association with Satan. And then although Satan's power has been severely restrained, he still has some influence and allies throughout the world who are opposed to Christ and his disciples. However, God decisively and completely, ultimately, defeats them in their efforts, along with Satan himself. And that is the important takeaway from this. So what is the application? Is there an application to us from all of this? Well, for the disciples in John's time, they would have received assurance that showed the victory of Christ over the system of emperor worship, because that was the greatest enemy of Christ at that time and in that day. That same assurance is given to Christians in every age that whatever is a great enemy of Christ and his people, it will ultimately fail, and Christ and his people will be victorious, are victorious. And although Satan's power has been severely restrained, he is still influential in the world, working against Christ and his people, working against us. And he's not to be underestimated. But Christ and his people will overcome Satan and all of his schemes. We should not be surprised by persecution and suffering. Recall what Jesus said to his apostles over in, it's recorded over in John chapter 15 during the Passover that he observed with his apostles right before his betrayal and arrest and crucifixion. One thing that he told his apostles was, if they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. Suffering is something that we all share in. We may not like to acknowledge it to one another, but each one of us has some level of suffering in our life, different times and in different extents and in different ways. And all suffering is not created equally. There is some suffering that we experience just as a part of the human condition. There's illness, there is injury, there's loss of a loved one, any number of things that we and everyone who has ever lived on earth experiences. And it brings to mind the statement in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11 that time and chance overtake them all. Time and chance happen to us all. So that's one type of suffering. There is suffering that is a consequence of our own sin. We recognize that when we sin, there are often and usually consequences that we suffer from that. If nothing else, guilt. Peter wrote to Christians in 1 Peter, he wrote to Christians who were suffering as well. But one of the things he says there is, don't suffer as an evildoer. So he acknowledged that if you're doing evil, you will, in fact, suffer. So that's another type of suffering. Then there's suffering that is a consequence of someone else's sin. Either we see it in their lives and it causes us suffering, or they actually sin against us and cause us suffering. But then there's suffering that is a consequence of our faith and our obedience to our Lord and Savior. And I think especially with suffering that arises out of persecution, we can feel overwhelmed. We can feel overwhelmed just as though the armies of Gog and Magog have gathered against us. But God has given us assurances in this regard. So back to what Peter wrote again in that same letter, and this is in chapter 4, same passage where he talks about don't suffer as an evildoer. He says that if you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. In verse 16, he says, if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. And it's interesting, that's one of only three places that the word Christian appears in the New Testament. And it's there in the context of suffering and our response to it. And then recall what Jesus taught early in his ministry. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So what practical takeaways can we glean from this prophecy? Well, one is that if we are faithful, we will suffer. Nevertheless, God cares. He cares deeply about his people. And just as the armies of Gog and Magog were very numerous, described as like this, and in Revelation, they're described as like the sand of the seashore, Satan has many, many tactics at his disposal to use against us. And Satan will use what is nearest and dearest to us against us. The defeat, though, of Gog, Magog, and Satan is complete, and it is decisive, and it is the work of God. And God has given us assurances of victory. He has given us assurances that he protects us from evil. Not necessarily from suffering. He protects us from evil, but not necessarily from suffering. And there are some passages that I think of that come to mind when I think about this assurance from God, starting in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. Paul wrote, "No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond that you are able. But with the temptation, will provide a way of escape so that you will be able to endure it." And I like the assurances that James wrote in the fourth chapter of his letter. Very concise and to the point. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And right after that, he says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Paul wrote in Romans chapter 8, verse 31, if God is for us, who can be against us? And I like what John also wrote in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4. For everything that has been born of God overcomes the world. And this is the overcoming that has overcome the world, our faith. We can overcome because he has already overcome. So hopefully this has been helpful in shedding some light on these somewhat obscure, perhaps, but connected prophecies, and encouraging us with the protection that God promises to us, to his people. So at this time, let's go ahead and stand, and we'll sing together, "The Battle Belongs to the Lord."